Do you think AI can actually make PMs like lazier and dumber? Because we rely on it for everything.
I think a lot of us lazier and dumber. Yeah. I do worry a bit about it. Even my experience, the best product people, not just PMs, but like designers too, have like deep intuition and really excellent product judgment. And then like, where did that good judgment come from? It's very, very difficult to build really good product judgment without having spoken to like many, many customers over many years in your domain. If the PM sits in 10 qualitative hour-long interviews versus like asking, you know, some software to like summarize the transcripts, they're just night and day different things. Just don't think you can build great judgment from getting AI to summarize all the issues all the time.
My guest today is Paul Adams, Chief Product Officer at Intercom. When ChatGPT launched, Paul and the Intercom team blew up their roadmap to go all in on AI. Since then, they built an AI-first customer service suite that can provide accurate answers to customers 24/7. Paul and I spoke about how PMs and designers can scale up on AI and get hired to work on AI products, why you may not want to start with the customer problem when building AI products, and how Intercom blew up its roadmap to build an AI chatbot that can resolve 50% of support queries without a human. Paul is an incredibly thoughtful product leader. Be sure to subscribe if you enjoy our conversation. All right, Paul, well, welcome. I'm really excited to talk to you today.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Very happy to be here.
Yeah. So, you know, we're both product managers and we both have been playing around with AI tools. To start, you know, maybe you can share what are some like most common data AI use cases that have helped you or PMs or designers on your team save time and get more stuff done?
Yeah, probably all the obvious things. You know, you hear from lots of people. I use AI these days a lot. I use ChatGPT a lot. For all the things you'd expect, I do research. I do a lot of research there as my kind of first starting place. I use it to learn about technology. Probably somewhere ironically, I use it to learn about AI. How AI works. You know, certainly the early months of this kind of AI era and revolution, I was using it to learn about like how do large language models work, or, you know, when someone says a term like RAG that I've never heard before, what does that mean and things. So I use it a lot for research. I use it for synthesizing and summarizing. You know, I go to a lot these days for trying to like take big bodies of content and summarize it down into something. Even if I have a really long blog post someone's written that I think is great, yeah, I'll ask AI to summarize it for me.
Yeah, pretty similar. And we use AI, do you like give it this like very long thought out prompts or just kind of have a conversation with it, or both?
Probably both. It depends. You know, in lots of cases I use it, like I use Google, you know, like I literally just write in a search query. Sometimes that will give me what I need and sometimes it won't. And then when it doesn't, I'll try and give it more instructions, you know, and try and clarify, like get it to clarify or get it to like constrain itself or give it a role. You know, you are a whatever. So sometimes I'll do that. But honestly, a lot of the time I'm using it, at least for research and things like that, in a very informal way. Yeah. I usually get what I need that way.
That like you're not ashamed to ask dumb questions too, right? Because it never judges you.
Yeah. That's right. I'll often follow up with things. Sometimes I guess I should kind of probably try to think about it now, do different things. But sometimes I'll write a question knowing that I probably need to ask more questions. You know, I'm kind of starting a conversation like with a colleague or with someone else where I expect there's more and I just start and experiment and see what comes back. And then I'll adapt and change and ask follow-ups and things like that.
Got it. Yeah. I mean, I personally use it. I use ChatGPT and Claude the most, and I use it to everything from like summarizing customer feedback to, you know, after a meeting, just like putting a bunch of raw notes in there and like telling you to make it more concise. Sometimes I even use it to just like, you know, when I'm trying to draft a product strategy or some of the higher level stuff, just to get a second opinion. Be like, hey, you know, this is the strategy. Yeah. Can you find some gaps? Can you find some alternative approaches?
Have you found it good to kind of do that well?
I think it's not perfect, but it gives me material to work with, right? It gives me like here's a bunch of options, here's a bunch of gaps. Maybe like half the things that it talks about are not really relevant. But the other half are actually pretty good. Like that actually helps me improve my stuff. Like I almost never just like straight up copy and paste AI's answers into my stuff. It's more like, oh, here's what you think and let me modify my answers based on what you say.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. It's like a sounding board or like, you know, quality control mode as well.
Do you think, like, because, you know, a couple of years ago, like, I personally never imagined AI would be really good at making art, at like writing poems, at like doing some of the creative stuff that humans do. So going back to the product world, do you think the risk here, do you think AI can actually make PMs and like lazier and dumber? Because we just rely on it for everything.
I think about a lot of us lazier and dumber. Yeah, I do worry a bit about it. You know, like I wrote a post on LinkedIn a while ago. I can't remember the exact what I said, but I wrote a post basically about like, I said something like AI will separate, like even further separate the great PMs from the like average PMs or whatever. And so that was a worry I had at the time. I still worry about it. I still think it's true. And the kind of idea there was, at least in my experience, the best product people, not just PMs, but like designers too, have like deep intuition and really excellent product judgment and kind of make bets or whatever that turn out to be good ones. Like, you know, later when you can kind of judge them with like data or more kind of quantitative things. And then like, where does that good judgment come from? And oftentimes it comes from a lot of talking to customers, you know, and it's very difficult to, I think, build really good product judgment without having spoken to like many customers over many years in your domain. And so one thing for sure is, you know, as an example, if a team is doing a research project to try and better understand the customer problem or customer space, and a PM sits in 10 qualitative hour-long interviews or does interviews themselves, even better, versus like asking, you know, some software to like summarize the 10 transcripts. They're just night and day different things, you know?
Yep.
Night and day. And I just don't think you can build great judgment from getting AI to summarize all the interviews all the time.
Yeah. You know, I've been mostly working at big companies my whole career, and a lot of big company PMs, like they don't even talk to customers, right? They just like, there's like a user researcher that talks to customers, and then they look at like a 20 page slide deck of what the customer said. And my opinion is like that stuff is useful, but it never just replaces just like talking to five customers yourself. You know, like
that's how you. Very much agree. And as I've, I guess, moved into more senior roles over time, like I run the product team now, it's much harder to kind of find the time to talk to customers, you know, and it's critical. It's a critical component. I don't do it enough anymore. I wish I did more of it. I think you just, there's something that AI can't yet do, I think, in it. And then maybe over time, there'll be versions that we can't even imagine yet where it'll do things like that. But for now, I think there's just, you build this incredibly powerful intuition and judgment from talking to people directly.
Yeah, I mean, like that's how you build like a product sense, right? You don't build it by like following some 20-step framework. You just like talk to like customers over a long period of time.
Right.
And look at the market that you build product sense. Yeah.
Yeah, I deeply believe that. But like you said, many people don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of like building a neural network in your brain a little bit. Like, you know, you just like make these connections that you're not even aware of. And then, you know, when you're trying to come up with a strategy or like build a product, that you have these intuitions that actually make sense.
Yeah, totally. It reminds me of, I used to often say like pre-AI days, I used to often say that I stole this from somewhere, I can't remember where. You know, every new idea, the only reason thing is like a uniquely new idea. Like every new idea is typically a combination of two existing ideas, but it's the combination that's new. And so to generate all these ideas, you just need to absorb and suck in more existing ideas. So there's something similar. It's the same kind of pattern matching that happens when you talk to like dozens and dozens of people, and subconsciously some processing's happening where your brain is like, you know, synthesizing, and it'll resurface back up in the future at some stage.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think about this? Like a lot of people on LinkedIn are like calling themselves like AI PMs now, like AI product manager certification. And I just feel like there's like a lot of noise here in this industry because of the hype. So from your perspective, like what are some good ways for PMs and designers to, you know, scale up on AI quickly and ignore the bullshit and actually like, you know, learn how to use this stuff?
I think at the start of any of these changes, I'm like, you know, it's a different way to describe this. I think we're at the start of a new era in technology, like one of the big waves, you know, maybe the last big wave might have been mobile. But yeah, these things kind of typically happen every kind of 10, 20 years, these big super cycles of tech. I think we're at the start of one for real. I think AI is going to be absolutely transformational, societally, transformational. And so at the start of these things, people gravitate to the words and the terms and things like that. Companies do it too, you know. Becoming an AI company or having an AI product as opposed to a product or a company I think in the future, the foreseeable future, all companies will need to be AI companies and all AI PMs. It will be the new standard. And so for now, I guess people are trying to differentiate themselves in the market maybe, but I think it'll all just go away. Like mobile, like, you know, we used to have like mobile first websites or like a mobile first strategy. And then we had just mobile only companies, Snap and, you know, the early gang. It's the same. It's going to be the same.
So the hype will go away, but like, you know, like you said, it's a real wave. So it is important to spend some more time to actually scale up on this stuff now. So is it just, you know, reading all the AI blog posts, or like, what's the best way to scale up, or that you've personally found to scale up?
Yeah, I do read a lot. Again, like similar to talking to customers, you only have so many hours in your day. But I wish I read more. I do think reading's a big part of it. I use Feedly personally, and then just have a bunch of different sources going into it, and I kind of bounce through it. You know, stuff comes in. I think a lot of it I read quite quickly. I kind of hope it goes in to my brain, and some of it sticks around, and then these patterns emerge later. You know, so reading's a big one. I read things like The Rundown, is like a kind of a newsletter that aggregates lots of different news and sources. That's really good, because reading The Rundown spins me off into like all sorts of things that would have never found anywhere else, you know? So that's very good. Trying stuff matters too. Like when you could build your own GPT, I built a piano teacher GPT and it didn't help me compared to piano, but I tried. So you have to try this. You have to try the products too and try the new things that come out. I think that's really important just to stay abreast of like what's happening, you know? Like one thing I haven't done, for example, yet, but I intend to, is a good example. It's like all the YC companies are kind of like emerging from the new batch, and there's a ton of fascinating stuff. So many of them are like AI companies, and you just need to go and try their products, and maybe you can sign up and maybe you can't, or maybe it'll make sense or maybe it won't, but you just got to try the thing as well for real to build an intuition for it. So reading, trying things is typically what I do.
Yeah.
At Intercom, I'm lucky. We have an AI team here. The team here has actually been around since the kind of mid-2010s. I learn a lot from talking to them, to be honest. Like, you know, we have different Slack channels where we talk about all the latest and greatest in the world of AI, and they educate me on new things, how things work, speculation in the industry, new types of models. Like when the latest version of Claude came out, you know, those discussions there about what, why or how it might be better or not, or, you know, technical things like that, for example. Yeah. So colleagues are a big source too.
Yeah. Like are folks on it, like are these folks like ML PhDs or just people who are, or a bit of both people who are.
Yeah, both. Both, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Our team, what used to be called Team ML back in the day, they rebranded since. They're an AI team. Some of the folks have PhDs. They're like deep specialists, but the team has to grow. Like we're growing the team as, you know, in big ways. We've lots of open roles in the team, like I'm sure many companies do. So we're also kind of like retraining is the wrong word, but like upskilling or other engineers in the company who want to learn much more about this world. And there's lots of them. And so, you know, folks that have been at Intercom for a while and have worked in the kind of classic product engineering role are now joining the AI team and learning that world too. So
yeah,
definitely a bit of both. Yeah.
So maybe we can flip this question around. Like as you're hiring for PMs or designers to work on AI products, what kind of qualifications are you looking for? Or like what kind of skills?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll give you my kind of personal philosophy, I guess. You know, I'm a big believer in generalists. Maybe that's because I'm a generalist. I'm a big believer in generalists. People who actually display like different types of attributes as opposed to any kind of hard skills. So for example, people who are curious, ambitious, people who kind of believe they can turn their hand to new things and do them, and they're kind of doers and makers, like inventor kind of people, you know, people who like have made things and have built things and tried things. I think those types of people can learn anything. And so that for me personally, like when I interview people, that they're the kind of things I'm looking for. Obviously it helps these days if people have technical knowledge and so on. But with AI, it's so new to so many people and it's going to be so big. We currently have this like massive gap between like all the types of people that we need to hire and the people with actual experience. And so for the most part, same as mobile, you know, I worked in the mobile team at Google when the iPhone came out. And then prior to the iPhone, we were building like J2ME apps, like the first versions of YouTube on phones and stuff like that. And at the time, it was people had to like learn mobile, you know, no one knew how to write mobile apps. No one knew how to design mobile apps. You know, when the iPhone showed up, it was a completely different UI paradigm, nothing like anything anyone had seen before. And so there was no like way to do it. So just regular people like me and mothers just applied our hand to it and tried to learn it, you know. I think we're in the same world now, where I'd much quicker hire like someone who didn't really have any AI experience necessarily, but they're curious and ambitious and like really wanted to learn and were trying things, like they'd build a few GPTs or they were reading the latest and greatest news and things like that, versus someone who might have had like 12 months experience building an AI product.
Got it. Yeah, you want people who have the kind of curiosity, the ability to kind of get their hands dirty, tinker of stuff themselves, right?
Yeah. And open-mindedness is a huge thing too, I think. Like, it's very easy, especially people with more experience, it's very easy to like, not necessarily dismiss the new tech or the new era or whatever, but you can definitely get caught up a bit in like trying to hold on to the skills or knowledge you had in the past. And I think AI has gone to completely make redundant loads of like classic lessons people think are universally true and last forever. So I think open-mindedness is a really big one.
Like applying some past companies' processes or patterns to a new company, you know, it typically doesn't work.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Very rarely works. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about building AI products and how it's different from a non-AI product. So you and your team delivered Finn, which I think is one of the first AI chatbots, right? After ChatGPT came out. And I believe it's a customer support bot. It has handled 8 million customer queries. It has resolved 80% of them. So what are some of like kind of your most important lessons in building Finn and like AI products in Intercom?
Yeah. Well, let me try and give you a tiny bit of context first, maybe. When ChatGPT came out, literally over the weekend, literally over that weekend, we being myself and other people like Owen, our CEO, co-founder, Des, you know, our co-founder, changed our mindset, changed our worlds. Literally overnight, we were like, this is one of those moments. You know, we are around long enough to have seen a couple of others. Like I mentioned the iPhone earlier. It's just one of those before and after. Like before was, I guess, pre. And then after, it's like everything has changed. And we just recognize it as one of those moments, I think, and took a bet on it. And so prior to that, we did have like an ML team, like I said. We did have a product called Resolution Bot. It did answer queries, customer support queries. And when Resolution Bot was set up pretty well, it did it really well, but it was so manual to set up. Like you had to give it all the answers, all the content. It would suggest, hey, I think these are the answers to the questions. And you'd have to like go, yep, that one, no, that's not right. You know, be very manual. When it was really good, it could do up to 50, 60% queries, but no one did it. You know, not no one, but very few people actually really spent the time to curate all the content. And the next thing, ChatGPT shows up and it's already kind of better, you know, just by having consumed the internet. And so now there's no manual setup, you know. Now, obviously, since then, there's tons of training that we've been doing and all sorts of fine tuning and stuff. But out of the box, it was really good with no setup. And we were like, okay, this is like before and after. Before was most bots are kind of crap, you know, honestly, like pretty crappy experience. Because they're not set up well, they're just not a great product. And then after is like, oh, the out of the box experience of the bot is actually really good, pretty good. And so we completely changed our roadmap and strategy and said, we must invest immediately in building a powerful LLM powered bot. And so we did, we built it in, we shipped it, I think 4 months later. And it's been transformational, you know, it's been totally different. Like, all the numbers are just night and day different. Out of the box, Finn was able to do kind of 25-ish, 28% of queries just by doing nothing, just by turning Finn on and giving it your knowledge base of content, your support help content. And now it's still with an average. And then now it's at 45% a year later. So if you look at the graph, like it's a bit jaggedy, but it's just up and to the right. We've added loads of power to it. It can do lots more things now, but now it's at 48%. And that's the average. We've customers, many customers who get 60, 70%, you know, which totally changes everything about their customer support experience. Changes their customers get like instant answers and the economics all change. So yeah, we went all in really early. We are all in now, like fully all in on AI, but we went in early and learned a lot early.
What was the team, like the team that shipped the initial version of Finn, or like is working on Finn? Was it like a small team, or you just put everybody, all the PMs on it, or
No, it was small. Well, people here have listened to this and they're going to be like, wasn't this? But it wasn't like all hands on deck, we're doing it. The whole company is doing this. We have like, the way we set up Intercom is that we've lots and lots of product teams that are fairly independent. The teams are like, you know, 8 to 10 people. They work on a part of the product, and then those various teams are grouped into groups. Kind of classic setup. So I can't remember, honestly, how many people worked on Finn. It might have been 2 or 3 teams, maybe. So you're looking at maybe 20 people. I don't even think it was that big. Maybe 20 people on the R&D side, on the product and engineering side. And then like it was as big a lift on the marketing side. Once we wanted to market it, we were like, hey, we need to do this properly. This isn't just another bot. This is like an agent. It's an AI agent, really. Or at least that's where it's going. And so we had a big marketing side to the launch as well, which is, so a lot of people ended up working on it in the end, but the majority, the vast majority of product and engineering at the time did not work on Finn initially.
Got it. Well, I think Finn is interesting because I think customer support is actually like, it actually is like a really good fit for AI, in my opinion. I haven't done a ton of customer support with like tech products, but like, my customer support experience is just like using Comcast or something, right? Like calling them. And it's like terrible, man. Like, you know, like this morning I called my retirement account company and like had to use my voice to navigate and like kept on getting it wrong. You know, like I would tell it information through the bot that then the person that I get asked me for the same information. Yeah. So I'm curious, like, this is like a bit of a side, but like how did the customer support industry come to this state? You know, like it's really devolved in my opinion.
Yeah. I think your appraisal is fair. You know, I would agree with it. I think customer support for the most part is pretty bad. And I'm sure everyone listening, you know, can, I guess resonates with most people. Even customer support people, when you talk to them, you know, they would say, yeah, most of the customer support I experience, not in my job, but is bad. So I think it is bad. And I think it's due a revolution. It hasn't seen like a ton of innovation in the last 10, 20 years. So I do agree with that. One interesting thing is, just a kind of a side note, people tend to think therefore that like people in CS don't really care, or, you know, and sometimes when you're on the phone with people, it may feel like they don't really care, but that's not really our experience. When we do research with our customer support leaders, and certainly in managers, they care deeply and they're trying really hard, but it's just the whole kind of thing is broken. Now, I think AI is going to fix this, which is an incredible opportunity. I think it's going to transform customer support. Because LLMs are really good at what CS people do, which I can elaborate on, but I think it's going to change it. But for now, like the economics are kind of broken. So there's more and more people going online, more and more businesses going online, more and more people have questions. We're moving to an era where people prefer messaging as their kind of communication channel. So it's easy to message. So more questions from more people, but you can't just keep adding more headcount to the customer support team. It just doesn't economically work that way. And so teams are under pressure to answer a lot of questions. So a lot of the time, a lot of the delay is just people trying really hard to get through the backlog of customer questions that they have. So that's like a big part of it. I think legacy software, I think I mentioned earlier, is another problem. Like just not much innovation in 10 or 20 years. A lot of customer support teams like Comcast or whoever, I don't know who Comcast uses, but or what product they use, but just legacy systems don't really talk to each other, don't integrate well. Hence like, oh, hey, Peter, thanks. But yeah, you know, what's in the back of that is the system my colleague used to ask you all your details. It's not the same thing I'm looking at. So I got to do it all over again. You know, just stuff like that has been bad. And maybe the thing that's held it back most is businesses don't see it as strategic. You know, a lot of businesses will say customer experience is paramount, but when it comes to the support team, it's almost always in a P&L and a cost center and something that's costs need to be managed and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's a bunch of things.
Got it. So it's not really seen as a revenue driver, or like it's kind of hard to tie it to some sort of revenue KPI, I guess.
Yeah. Like the KPIs for customer support are things like, you know, a lot of them kind of come back to kind of, you know, unit economic stuff, but like time to resolution, first response times. Like these are customer satisfaction scores and customer satisfaction metrics, but underneath them all is like trying to manage the workforce. You know, a big part of a customer support manager's job is managing your team and trying to get as many of the people in the team to answer as many questions as they can really well, which is really hard to do. really hard to do.
So maybe you talk about Finn a little bit. Maybe talk about how Intercom holistically uses AI to solve this thing, like to both make the customers happy and the customer support agents have happy too.
Yeah. So I think it's a fascinating case study, by the way. Obviously, like I'm mired in the world, this world of customer support and AI, but I do think it's going to be one of the very first really positive changes that will happen. You know, a lot of people like to talk about whether AI is going to be good or bad for us, and maybe it won't do good things at times and so on. I think customer service will be one of those areas where people can noticeably see how much better it is. And the reason for that is, like I said earlier, it just turns out, like, you know, through no grand design, I don't think, it just turns out that a lot of the things that LLMs are really good at happen to overlap heavily with a lot of the things that customer support reps do, like, you know, converse back and forth, answer questions, ask clarifying questions, summarize information, synthesize different pieces of, you know, information and content and so on. But the AI can do this faster than a person, and it can do it 24/7, and it can do it in any language, you know? So suddenly it's like, you're really good at this. That this needs to be clarified, that this is like, for now, the simpler questions. You know, customer support questions come in like different flavors. You have simpler questions like, do you ship to Ireland? Or, you know, even things like, is my flight delayed? Or things like that. They're kind of a pretty clear yes, no answer. But then you have like more complicated questions like troubleshooting, or like people not really sure what the problem is. It could be a bug, or it could be a product problem, or, you know, it could be product confusion. It's just really, and you know, a lot of troubleshooting. Letting that get turned into like, I need to contact the engineering team, or your bill is wrong, I need to ask my finance team, you know. So these complicated questions are still done by people, but AI is answering all the easy questions and getting better and better. It's starting to take actions as well, like actually change things and write back to databases and so on, write back to systems. So it can do things like change my, you know, oh, my flight's delayed, can you please change my flight? Yeah, I can change your flight. You know, with the right permissioning and setup, it can do actions really well. And people are then left with all the hard stuff, which actually is good. It makes the job a lot easier. Yeah. Or sorry, like not easier, makes it probably harder. It makes the job more interesting, a lot more interesting. And in that world, AI is going to change everything as well, because all of the human reps answering the hard questions are going to have a co-pilot. You know, we've been building in co-pilot for the last few months, and it's also transformational. You know, it's as transformational as the Finn agent is. So this whole world is going to get changed.
Well, what's an example of a hard question, like, you know, that you need a human?
Yeah. There's different flavors of them. So one could just be, someone might literally write in, the product doesn't work anymore. And you're like, okay, product doesn't work anymore. What does that mean? So suddenly you're into like, and the agent can do a lot of the back and forth. Like, you know, okay, can you clarify what you mean? Or can you tell me more? And it can start to disambiguate. And sometimes that might result in the AI agent answering the question. But sometimes it's just unknown, you know, like maybe there's a bug, maybe the product isn't working properly, or maybe there's like bad data somewhere along the line, or, you know, it's just really unclear. And it takes a lot of investigation across kind of different teams in a company. A company get quite complicated. So yeah, it can take a lot of different people from different teams before you get to a resolution. Now, like, so that's an example. Well, it's kind of an abstract example, but something like my bill is wrong. You know, hey, my bill is wrong. It's $97. I'm supposed to be on like $43 a month. That could be a lot of things. It could be all sorts of system problems in all sorts of different parts of the company. And it requires like troubleshooting and back and forth. And so today, people use ticketing for this and tickets. So today, ticketing works pretty well, but it's expensive and hard. And over time, AI will certainly get better at this. And AI will help disambiguate. The AI will start to talk to all the different departments. And then the finance AI with co-pilot will talk to the engineering AI co-pilot. You know, and it'll definitely start to answer more and more of the hard questions, for sure. I think like over time, who knows how fast this will happen, but it's happening even faster than we thought it would. Over time, it'll get down to 5% maybe of questions might be answered by people. And then usually that's a strategic decision. Like, hey, our VIPs always get humans. Or there's some reason, like, or we hear this from some of our customers, like we differentiate on really personal support and bots, AI agents, they're not humans. They don't have empathy. You know, they don't have these human qualities. And so we want people in the mix. We want people talking to people. And then, you know, they differentiate on that. So we'll see. We'll have to see how it goes out.
Yeah, but I think you can challenge all that too, right? Like you can make the bot very personable too. Like the bot can just remember all your past conversations.
Yeah, for sure.
Nothing, like going back to keeping an open mind, like nothing's impossible at this point.
No, not at all. And I do think over the course of like, you know, years, many years, is it 5 years? I think over the course of a small number of years, the vast majority of customer questions, so I'm saying like 90% plus, will be answered by an agent, an AI agent, because they're just going to be faster, quicker, accurate. And like a lot of the time, customer support questions, it's not like the customer wants to talk to someone. You know, that's just a means to an end. They just want a resolution or an answer. And if a bot or an agent can do it like excellently, instantly, that's a better customer experience, just a way better customer experience. So this is like, well, of course we should choose the way better customer experience that our customers love. And then that actually, I think it is also going to be great for the customer support industry. It frees people up to work on much more interesting things, I think. Rather than like answer the same question over and over again, you get to work on things like hard questions, or as more and more of them get answered, you get to work on designing the system. You know, like we already have a role here at Intercom called conversation designer. And so they're designing the conversation paths, like how does the bot work and when does it fire or who gets what type of experience and so on. So there'll be loads and loads of cool jobs, and the bot is only ever as good as the content and data that it's sourcing, referencing. And so there'll be just really new types of jobs too on the content side, the data side. So I think for CS people, there's actually really interesting new types of career opportunities.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Because right now it kind of sucks being a CS, right? Like you get yelled at by a customer, you say the same thing, like reset the router like 100 times.
Yeah.
It's not like
it's a tough gig. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I do think it's a win, you know, You know, a lot of people talk about, you know, will that mean like fewer jobs in CS and so on? But a lot of people use those jobs as stepping stones into other types of careers as well. So I think it'll work out just fine, actually. And it'll be, like I said, it's a great example of like AI being applied and making things genuinely better.
Awesome. Let's go back to kind of building AI products, building FAIN and other products. Do you have any kind of like non-intuitive like principles? Like I built some AI products and, you know, for example, is it still really important to start with a customer problem? Like what about the issue with this thing? Just like infinite amount of edge cases, right? It's very hard to be deterministic with what this thing actually does.
Yeah,
like,
here's a funny kind of turning I've had. I said earlier, I'm a generous. I'm kind of like a jack of all trades master. I've worked in as an IC, like individual contributor. I've worked as a PM, I've worked as a designer, worked as a researcher. And as a result of that, kind of like doing all those types of roles, I was very much into like, you must start with customer problems. You must start with customers. You must start with customer problems. That's always the starting point. And I guess I was, maybe like reacting a little bit to like parts of my career in other companies where it is quite used to happen at Google quite a lot when I was there. Like just people would start with the tech, you know, they start with the technology and like build things that were cool and that they thought were interesting, intellectually interesting and stuff. And like all the failed products resulted out of that. Like no one actually cared. It wasn't solving a real problem. So at Intercom, we have these three principles upon which we build all of our process. And I always say to people, like, I don't really care. The process is there to follow the principles. But if you follow the principles and don't really follow the process, I don't really care. But I care a lot that people follow the principles. I don't need three of them. The first one says, start with the problem. And the other two, by the way, are like, think big, start small, and ship to learn. And we've changed it a bit over the years. We've added one about outcomes now, deliver outcomes, because we were very output focused. But the first one, start with the problem. With AI, we don't do that necessarily. And I've had to like, okay, wrap my head around, is this good or is it bad? And a lot of it is around the idea that like, we don't really know what's possible with AI, you know, and we're learning all the time. We're getting new models all the time. The thing is moving at breakneck speed. And so like, I'll give you an example. So it's concrete, you know, we're building a new product and like for support leaders. So what do support leaders do? They analyze information. They look at, do a lot of reports, insights, trying to figure out how to improve their customer service through dashboards. And we're like, AI is good at that. AI is really good at that kind of stuff. AI is really good at like sucking information, reports, data, generating charts, like amazing. But is it possible? Like ChatGPT can generate a chart, but can our like CS trained, you know, AI model actually do it for real? And we don't know, you know. Now we've built some stuff and it's working out in places, but we don't know. And we don't know what's possible. And some stuff doesn't work. Like when we're building Copilot, which is, you know, a conversation, you can talk to Copilot as a support rep, and it's basically a buddy to help you, like GitHub's Copilot. And it's conversational and it's really good. It can help you a lot. But when we were building it, we built a different thing first and didn't work. And we thought it was going to be easy. So these days I say to people, like, we got to be open-minded. Maybe we start with, is this thing possible? And if it's possible, then we can map it to a customer problem we know exists for real. So it's a bit like chicken and egg. And I've always followed this, like, or I've always put forward this, like, problem first, solution second. But those days have changed for sure.
That changed. Maybe just about, can you repeat your principles again? It's start with the problem. Yeah,
start with the problem. I think people in Intercom will laugh at me for probably getting the name slightly wrong. I'll tell you what the ideas are behind them. Start with the problem. So that's basically like, do proper customer research, properly understand your customer, make sure that the problem is real, and make sure that there's high energy around it. Like oftentimes you can have a problem, a customer problem that's real, but they don't really care, you know? And I've worked in many projects over the years where like, we solved a real customer problem and then no one used the product. Then we go, why aren't you using the product? Like, oh, I don't really care about that. I mean, that's a real problem, right? It's good, nice. I like what you did. It's cool. I like it. But I don't really care about it. So high energy, you know, that's the first one. And then our second one is, it now says, as far as I can remember, think big, start small, ship to learn. So we used to have think big, start small, and ship to learn as a separate principle. We merged them. So think big means like think big, have a vision for the product space. Like think about what it might look like in a year, but don't start by building that. You know, start with the smallest, tiniest solution to the problem you existed. So there is some order to these. Understand the problem deeply and then start small. Like we're like, we try and be ruthless on scope and like get creative on the smallest possible. That's the fastest to build and then ship to learn, ship it. Maybe we got it wrong. Maybe something didn't work out properly. Maybe the research you did wasn't quite right, you know. So ship to learn is part of now think big, start small, ship to learn. And then do that a lot. And then you can kind of like really get good fast. And then the third one now is called, we changed it and ship to learn, got it moved in. The third one now is called deliver outcomes. So set some kind of success metric up front. What does success actually look like? And make sure you deliver that outcome. Don't stop at like, we shipped the feature. Stop at, and people used it, you know.
I really like the second one. Think big, start small, ship to learn. Because a lot of people online talk about like there's execution and then there's strategy, right? But like in reality, the two things are like really tied together. Like I worked at companies where people have a big vision, they think big, and they don't ship anything for like a year. Yeah. and then finally ship. It's like a watered down version of what they thought about, and no one wants to use it.
Absolutely. That resonates with me too.
So yeah, to me, I don't know if you agree with this, like, but like to me, these two things are like heavily tied together, like strategy and execution. You're going to have a point of view, but you got to execute to learn. Cause like most likely your point of view is probably not correct or need some adjustment.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm trying to remember, we used to have like a different saying internally in Intercom years ago. Oh, it was be confident, but humble. That's what you used to say. It wasn't a principle. It was more like a value culture value. It was like be confident, but humble. And what that meant was like, build up the confidence to think you've done a good job. Like you did good research. You did understand customers. They were involved in the process, you know, but be humble. Like we're probably wrong here. We're definitely wrong somewhere. There's no way you never get anything 100% right. So there's something wrong in here. And then that kind of gives you like, or puts you in the mindset that like, this is kind of messy, you know, it's a lot messier than people make it out. And I think strategy execution is similar. It's a lot messier than people try and make it out. And in reality, like there's this is constant feedback loops, you know, and with the strategy docs we write at Intercom, at least certainly strategy docs I write, I'm always forever saying to people, these are live. These change. They change all the time. I know it might be a bit chaotic. I know it might be a bit confusing. Yes, I did change it again last week in that small way. I'm trying to communicate the change. But the strategy docs should always be live, in my opinion, and changing. Now, like, you need to be careful to change it too much, or like you just have total chaos. Yeah. But I mean, in the AI world, it moves so fast that these things are going to change fast.
Yeah. As long as people like just want to find the truth, you know, it's like some of the changes are pretty obvious, right? Because like we learn something new and like it's got to change it. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about organization design? I mean, since you're like a chief product officer, what about like when you want to make a big AI bet, like a 0-to-1 bet, do you like, you get the CPO or CEO to personally PM this thing, or you like get like four teams to combine into one team, or you just get a small team of really good people to work on this first? Yeah.
Definitely small teams. I and we at Intercom definitely gravitate to small teams and try to give teams as much independence as possible. So we try and set up a strategy and try and set up a roadmap in such a way that teams are fairly free to set their own roadmap as long as they follow the strategy and then follow the principles. So, you know, follow the strategy, follow the principles. And then we've lots and lots of individual teams. Even when we create new things, I'm trying to remember, like Finn, I think I said was 1 to 2 teams. There's the AI. We have a separate AI group. Okay. We were talking about that earlier. And the AI group originally was like a small independent team, but now of course it must be everything eventually. All teams must be AI teams ultimately in the foreseeable future. And so we've started to blend them a lot more, where some of our regular folks, like I was saying, kind of go and, you know, learn about AI. Some of the AI folks go and work on projects outside of the AI group. We're trying to like move to a world where it's much more blended, but still small teams. Like, even if we're building a brand new product, we will try and keep it to like a team or two teams, which is somewhere between 10 and 20 people.
Yeah. Yeah. This is why there's like the thing called like PM's influence without authority. I'm like, dude, like if you spend all your time influencing the authority, you're not really learning from the market.
You gotta make, you gotta do, you know, I think you gotta do directly, be very close to the work.
Do you just like a few more questions? Like when you set up a small team, do you give them like a OKR or something, or do you give them some, like, how do you set an OKR around learning, or like not just like you gotta get to like a million DAU right away? Like, you know, how do you give some rope?
We don't do OKRs. We, it's kind of difficult to answer this question. Personally, I'm really big into goal setting. So I kind of am obsessed probably to the, I don't know, it's probably not healthy for me, but I obsess with goals and goal setting. And so like, for example, in my team, I set weekly goals every single week. I set quarterly goals and then I set weekly goals for me and all my team do it. And we all set weekly goals. And then teams set weekly goals. So all these product engineering teams all set weekly goals. And then we work in 6-week cycles. So I'm kind of doing this backwards, actually. I should have started the other way around. But let me keep going. So weekly goals ladder up into 6 weekly goals. We have 6-week cycles. We found 6 weeks to be this like Goldilocks time horizon where it's far enough out that you can predict pretty accurately what you can and can't do. But it's also far enough out that you can do a lot. Like you can build a lot in 6 weeks. So it's kind of nice, this nice Goldilocks, not too far ahead and everything goes off track, but not too short term where you can't really be ambitious. And then we do a quarterly roadmap and a kind of a half roadmap. The quarterly one is kind of check-ins. The roadmap's actually these days more like 6 months, actually. So 6-month roadmap, and each team has their own roadmap. Each of these individual small product teams has their own roadmap. And so, and then it ladders up to the strategy. So we have our kind of product strategy. And then people can see which piece of it they own. It's kind of pretty clear in the Intercom products. Like there's a human support group. They own all the human support sides, like humans answering customer support. We have an automation side, like all of the non-human answered questions, like Finn, AI agent and things like that. And we have a platform group, you know, work on things like integrations and interoperability and stuff. So it's pretty clear which part of the strategy they own. And then from there, they set their own roadmap, set their own goals, execute to the goals. And that's how it works. Okay. And it works really well. Historically, we've been very good at shipping like output, you know, quite predictably because of the people following the principles, but it's changing a bit with AI now where,
yeah,
you know, we'll see. Yeah. Well, let's see. So,
So basically you're actually letting the team set their own goals, and like, as long as you agree with them, like, you know,
personally, I'm not involved. Sometimes I talk to other like CPOs or heads of product, and they think what I think is kind of crazy in some ways, but I'm not involved. I have a team below me who are like a combination of PM leaders and design leaders, and then research and data science. They actually approve all of the roadmaps. They're in all the roadmap meetings. They do all the approvals. And I'm operating at the kind of strategy level most of the time. And then now and again, things will bubble up, or I might care about something, you know, more than something else, and I'll dig down a bit or whatever and try and shape an opinion. But, you know, we try and stay at the right Zoom level, try and have people stay at the right Zoom level. So the teams themselves and the group level set the goals, set the roadmap. And most of the time it works. Like, it's very rare. It happens now and again, but it's rare that there'd be like a significant course correction, you know? And then I think that's just because you have to have a really clear strategy for people.
That makes sense. Yeah. You don't have too many people staying at the next 3 months level. Otherwise it's like, you kind of just micromanage them too much. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the Zoom level thing is a huge, if you can get it right, everyone feels empowered at the right level. It just frees up people's time as well.
I guess last question, I think it's kind of like a privilege to be like a product person when this AI revolution is happening, right? It's like, it makes things so much more interesting again.
Yeah.
Do you have any closing words of advice for people who are watching this, or people who are reading this?
I agree. I think it's an incredible privilege. I age myself with these comments. I'm kind of like old enough just about to kind of seen kind of three of these things. The internet was the first one, you know, when I was in school, there was no internet really, you know, and it was when I was in college that it kind of became a thing. And so the internet happened, and that just changed society, deeply changed how society operates. And then the next one is kind of 10 years later, call it mobile, call it social, you know, but like, if people forget, like, if, you know, if I want to like see what my friend who lives in the other side of the world is doing, I can see in real time HD what they're doing. They can video call me like, check it out. Not that long ago, you had to like take a photograph, print it, put it in an envelope and post it to the other side of the world. You know, like, there's transformational societal change. And this is another wave of that. It's the next wave. And I think that AI is going to be much bigger than mobile. I think it's going to be bigger than the internet. I think maybe we're talking like industrial revolution stuff here. Maybe we're actually talking about, you know, the industrial revolution completely changed how people live and work. Maybe we're talking urbanization, you know, people moved into cities and factories and all sorts of stuff. We could literally be talking about like a complete change in how humanity lives. And I think it's incredibly fortunate that we get to try and help design that world. Like, you know, how lucky are we? I agree with you. I think it's a privilege. A responsibility too, not to do it badly, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's a privilege. I think it's an amazing time to work in software. Amazing. It's like the whole world's been given a new birth, new energy. I think it's awesome.
So you think it's just like being open-minded, approach it from a beginner's perspective again?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, here's kind of something that's really kind of unusual. I think a lot of people thought AI was going to take, you know, like lower paid jobs and just like kind of just revolution kind of change things. But like factories and robotics in 50 years ago, you know, cars are now made by robots, but cars used to be made by people, you know? And actually like what AI is really good at is all these like knowledge worker jobs, you know, us basically, all of us. And, you know, back to the stuff we were talking about earlier, you know, AI can help you be a PM. AI will be a PM. And I think it's going to really change what work looks like. And I think the way you thrive in that world is you stay, beginner mindset, like real true. Maybe most of what I've learned so far is going to be irrelevant in 5 years. And my job's going to look completely different than it does today. And 80% of the code for my product will be written by AI, not by people. Like just all sorts of things are going to totally change. And you have to have that like willingness to just shed the knowledge you've built up. Very hard to do, but necessary.
Yeah, I think so. I think especially, you know, I don't know about you, but like I'm pretty old too. And like I have kids and stuff. And when I was younger, you know, I like sometimes when I like play with some AI tools on the weekend, I'm like, am I wasting my time here? Like, should I go back to writing my PRD or am I just screwing around? But actually, like, this stuff, it could actually be the job of the future, right? Like, the writing a PRD is not a job of the future. It's actually like playing all these like music tools, playing with all the AI tools and learning what's possible. So I think that's the important part of the process. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I don't know what the skills of the future look like, but certainly like people, I think people who make things and try things in these types of periods of history, the people who actually go and make stuff and try stuff and, you know, hack at it, like the word hack has a kind of, can have different connotations, but, you know, I think hacker culture is good and healthy and positive and awesome. And, you know, I'm sure like 100 years ago, the people who were winning were the people who were making, tinkering and making stuff mechanically or whatever. And I think the same is true now. And I think, yeah, a lot of the job of the future might be a lot more of that type of thing.
Totally agree, man. All right, Paul. Well, thanks so much for chatting.
It's great to have you here. Thanks for having me. Yeah,
cool.
Enjoyed it.